This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Soledad Santiago, says she has experienced the extremes of life in New York City, from being homeless to sitting at conference tables at the highest level of state government. Santiago is a journalist who has written about the urban poor. In 1980, she created a Latin supplement for the Village Voice. For a while, she crossed over to work for the government as deputy press secretary to New York's attorney general and head of the city press office for the state's controller. Now she's been writing about the extremes of city life in her fiction. Her second novel, Room 9, has just been published. It's a crime story about corruption in City Hall. Santiago started writing fiction after she figured out she wasn't going to get any further in state government.
I found myself terribly frustrated that I was so close to the power, but I had no power. Given my background and my own personal struggles, I was often disappointed that government was so removed from people's actual needs when I saw that there was so much potential to actually make people's lives better.
How did you end up writing fiction?
That was where I could put the most truth.
Now, I think a lot of people would assume from hearing your name, Soledad Santiago, that you're Latina, but you're not really, so I'm going to ask you to describe how you got your name.
Okay, that's kind of was a rather long evolution. My mother is Swiss and my father Turkish, and I came to this country and I was 12 years old. We moved then to Princeton, New Jersey, to the first planned interracial community in that. It's a university town. And I was bussed in along with the other kids. There was a black family, a family from India, a family from South America. So my identification when I arrived in this country was sort of immediately on that side of the fence. I came to New York during the 60s and married a Puerto Rican nationalist. And I began my writing while I was married to him. And I took the name Soledad, if you remember George Jackson and the Soledad brothers. I was very moved by his writing. He was a young man who had made some mistakes as a teenager and wound up being in prison for life as a result. And I was young myself, and I was able to see, although I'm a pacifist and I don't think I'll ever change that, I was able to see how from his position he wouldn't be able to see any other solution than to bring the entire system down. And I felt his pain. I guess I was myself been sort of an eternal outsider. And so I took that name in honor of him and of the struggle that he represented to me at that time. And I felt in later years that it would be wrong for me to throw that away because it was and is a part of me.
You've written a lot about Latino issues. You've even edited a publication called Latin New York. I wonder how you felt about doing all of that Latino work but not really being Latino yourself.
Well, that's a really interesting question for me because I think that in the Puerto Rican community, and I think this probably happens also to many women in marriage, is that to some extent they take on the husband's identity. And for me, it was a particularly comfortable identity because I had never really belonged in any group. As a Turk in Germany and Switzerland, you were very much an outsider. Then I came to Canada and I spoke German, and it was not that long after the war, and that wasn't very well liked. In the Puerto Rican community, it was the first time in my life, and I guess also partly because of the way I look and I learned the language, that I could blend and be allowed to fit. So I have two children that are half Puerto Rican, a very great love for that culture and community.
You sent us a short biographical statement that you'd written up to accompany the book, and it seems like you've had such an interesting life. Now, you were saying that when your family moved to the States, you moved in into a planned integrated community just outside of Princeton. But apparently when you were 16, your parents sent you back to Europe because you had become a discipline problem.
Right.
What were you doing that was such a problem to them?
Well, I guess I was becoming American. I mean, my father, even though he became a Unitarian, he was born a Muslim. And I mean, the idea of my dating or going to school dances or shaving my armpits, these were things that, and I'm the oldest in my family. So I think it was traumatic. And I also, I think I just got nasty because I didn't fit in my own mind. I didn't think I could fit in Princeton. And Princeton High School is a very good school academically, and I had been to so many schools. And so I think, like many people, even in the Puerto Rican community, you know, the idea is you send the person back to the place of origin. I couldn't go back to Turkey. Even my own father couldn't go back to Turkey for political reasons. But that life would be slower there and that I would be slowed down. And in essence, they were right about that. But, of course, what happened was that I couldn't fit in there again either. And first of all, my language skills were not up to gymnasium, which is the level before university. So things got really worse for me, in a sense. And I then went to Italy and worked as an au pair, and I was kind of happy there.
When you were sent back to Germany, who was taking care of you?
My mother's sister, my mother's one of three sisters, one married a Turk, one married an Italian, and one married a German. And I was actually traded. My one of my cousins came over for a year. And his family, he became a filmmaker, a radical filmmaker in Berlin. And his family attributes that to the fact of his year in America. You know, that ruined him.
So how did you get back to the States?
It was after President Kennedy was shot, and I was profoundly affected by that, as was my family. I mean, my father's whole dream in life was to come to America. He even put his birthday on the 4th of July because he wasn't exactly sure in the small village where he came from when his birthday was, but he knew it was around that time of year. And he had come from a village that if you went there today, I mean, I went there recently, it's like going back to the time of the Bible, and he was the only one that got out and got an education. And he wanted me to come home and get an education. To him, that was the way to have a future. And even though I had only done 3 years of high school, I had been a good student, I had enough credits to get into NYU. My father actually applied for me. I mean, he was, I guess, in some sense, old school, and got me. All of a sudden, I had a scholarship to NYU, so I had to come back.
Did you find it any easier to fit into the States when you came back a little older after your stay in Europe?
Well, interestingly enough, when I came back to the States, I went to Weinstein Dormitory in the village, and I had never been exposed to anything like New York City. And there you are, down there in the village, the cusp of late 60s, early 70s. You know, I got right in with everything other than the academics. I was kind of chubby in those days when that was great in Italy. You know, they kept saying, mangia, mangia. But in the United States, I couldn't get a date. So, and those are the things that are kind of more important at that age. So it was, again, difficult. I mean, it was kind of a long, hard trek, and I'm sure in many ways it made it harder for myself because I didn't know how to help myself back then. I mean, nowadays, you know, we would say, okay, we'll go for some counseling, talk this thing through. But back then, that was it was not something that was in my family's frame of reference.
My guest is journalist and novelist Soledad Santiago. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Soledad Santiago, and she's a journalist, a novelist, and also a former deputy press secretary to New York's attorney general and former head of the New York City press office for the New York State Comptroller. She's written a new suspense novel, which is called Room 9. Let's skip ahead a little bit in your life story. You had married a Puerto Rican journalist, and then you headed an anti-narcotics program. You did some theater work. At age 30, you divorced, and you ended up briefly homeless. How did you end up homeless?
Well, the divorce was extremely traumatic, and we'd never had a lot of money in the first place. But suddenly I found myself without any money. I had made a stupid move, and I guess, you know, that's why I identify so much with people who wind up in this situation. The breakup was so traumatic that I left the apartment. I said, you keep it. He, of course, wound up leaving and going with his new partner, and I wound up in a furnished room. I had to separate my children at that point while I was trying to find work. And this is one of the things that I think is still going on today. At that point, I tried to get public assistance, and the system actually is, it's a system in which you have to fight your way through. Rather than it reaching its hand towards you, it lets you fall down first. And so I was told, well, come back when you have nothing. I was told that the furnished room that I lived in did not qualify because there was a bathroom in the hallway, and so that that I could not continue living there if I received public assistance. So they essentially waited until I had nothing and I was thrown out of that room. And then they said, okay, now we'll help you in the Martinique Hotel, which even then, which was the beginning sort of the wave of homelessness that has grown ever since. Even then, that was a nightmare.
That's basically an SRO, Martinique?
It was the era when they were taking actual hotels that really weren't quite making it and using them to house the homeless. The justification being, and it still is kind of the justification, that federal monies only allow you to pay for temporary shelter. They don't allow you. You, for example, you can pay $3,000 a week for a hotel, but you can't give a family a reasonable deposit on an apartment.
Oh, in other words, so you could put them up in temporary shelter, but you can't help them toward a permanent home.
Right.
So what year was this?
Let's see, my son was about 2, and he's 16 now, so 14 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what I'd like to emphasize about that is that I was able to solve my situation rather quickly, and I didn't suffer that long. But I think it's because I did have the tools of very much a middle-class background. And I think if you don't have those tools, if you can't fight the system in order to get what the system is supposed to give you, you're in a lot of trouble. And I think that's the situation most homeless mothers find themselves in.
How long were you homeless?
It wasn't very long. I mean, I think we were in that hotel for a week or two, and then I had been fighting for about a year to get a wonderful apartment in a Section 8 building where Manhattan Plaza, where you had to be in the performing arts to live there. And I went before the committee, and I fought my way through because I had written a play and some children's television, and I asserted that that gave me the right to say that I was in the performing arts, and I won that. And again, I mean, it was because I knew how to fight.
Right, and because you had some credits.
Right,
that
right.
You had a resume that you could point to.
Exactly, you know, and I knew how to, you know, I was doing some freelance work at NBC during this time, and I'd walk to NBC because I didn't have car fare. You know, I would make my calls in search of, you know, saving my family from NBC or wherever I was working at the time.
So I'm interested in what it was like inside the Martinique. Would you just physically describe the room
yeah.
and the floor that you were in?
It was a hotel sort of very close to Macy's. It was right in Herald Square. Ironically, sort of in the shopping center of New York City. And it was a nice old hotel and had been at some point, I'm sure a nice hotel with a very big lobby. The particular room that we had faced right out onto the square. It was a small room, you know, with a bed and some rodents. I had to keep my son close to me because they would come out at night in droves. I mean, you could watch the mice play. You could also see the rodents on the window ledges, like the bigger rodents.
You mean like rats?
Yeah. the really frightening part was that it was really impossible to really lock your door. And that was the scariest part.
Who ruled inside the hotel?
Well, I mean, I wasn't long enough to be subjected to who ruled, but I would imagine from journalism that I've done later, and from we also wound up living diagonally across from the Holland Hotel for many years, and went in there a few times. My son was so curious. He wanted to see what it was like. And I think the way that it works is that the children are very much on their own because the adults are just struggling and not making it in a lot of ways. The children form gangs in order to survive, even though they're very young. You'll see 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12-year-olds traveling in small gangs. And, it's the tough who rule.
You wrote an article, an op-ed piece for New York Newsday about, and this was after you were homeless, but this was an article about how your son came home from school one day and said that he had been attacked by a gang of kids who lived in one of the homeless shelters. And now he felt that he needed some kind of weapon or some kind of protection.
Right.
But I was wondering how you felt about living near a homeless shelter. I'd imagine you'd be very ambivalent about it on the one hand as someone who...
Very ambivalent.
Who really supports homeless rights. You'd really want shelters and good places for people to live. On the other hand, you realize the kind of lawlessness and crime that sometimes comes out of the shelters. And
right. Well, now we were on the other side of the fence, and we were living in what is essentially a luxury building with a playground for the children. And across from us was this hellhole. And so the children that live in the hellhole would try to, you know, come and get a bicycle or the things that they didn't have. And yes, I felt very ambivalent because now I felt my own child threatened. And, you know, he's angry and hurt. And so you find yourself put in the position of trying to explain to your child that, look, this could have been you. And at the same time, you can't condone, you know, the violence, and you can't put your child in the position of saying you got to go out there and fight for your life every day on the way to school.
So how was the situation resolved when your son wanted protection?
Well, we had a huge argument. He thought that he was going to be protecting himself by carrying a Swiss Army knife in his sock. And, I mean, I have lived enough of the street life to be able to tell him that he would be worse off if he had a weapon that he really didn't know how to use. And I explained to him that although he's strong and he has integrity, that he cannot compete in terms of viciousness with somebody who was raised on crumbs and had to fight for those crumbs from the time they were an infant.
So did he get anything?
So, well, I'm sure he snuck his weapons now and then anyway. And he had, I mean, it was a long, frightening time. And then I must admit, when I sold my first book, I took that money and I did what I guess a lot of people would call cop out. I put my son into a private school outside of New York City because I felt that that was not a battle I could wage.
With the battle of having him facing knives and guns on the way to school every day?
Yeah, and just the pull and the romance of the streets also. First of all, you're dealing in a situation when you're it's all right in lower grades. You can make it through. But when your child reaches junior high school, you're now dealing with a situation where even to bump into somebody in the hallway at school is dangerous because it can provoke violence. So there's that element. There's also the fact that as I said before, a teenager is searching for identity. Now, here they are growing up in the middle of all this hypocrisy. And whatever else we say, the life of the Stoops and the music smoking a little reefer is appealing. Why wouldn't it be? I mean, what else are we really showing them? This is where they can get to play grown-up.
When you sent your son to a private school outside the city, were you reminded of the days when your parents sent you to Europe?
It was a hard time. I mean, it was a lot of tears on both sides and a lot of explaining, look, I'm doing this because I love you. I'm doing this because I want you to have a future. I'm doing this because right now I don't know any other way to do it. And he's 16 now, and I have to say that it really has worked because he is the kind of young man, and I think, you know, most kids are like this, who is very affected by his environment. And he's now in an environment where academic competition and sports competition is valued. See, I wasn't valued in the environment that he was in before. Other things were valued, you know, like how tough can you be? How early can you have sex? So now he has, like me, a foot in both worlds.
Let me change the subject completely here and get back to your novel, Room 9. There are, you know, in the novel, the assistant to the mayor, a woman, has this very passionate romance with a journalist who's covering scandal within the city, and it's kind of a conflict of interest, but they're having this romance anyways. And you write some pretty torrid sex scenes between them. I'm wondering if that was your idea or if your editor said, you've got to get that kind of stuff in here.
I think we say, have I ever had torrid sex?
No, yes, have you ever had torrid sex? Yeah.
No, I mean, it's funny, you do raise an issue because my first novel, Undercover, was a story of a woman police officer who was in a lot of trouble trying to work her way out of it, and there was no sex at all. And in the rewrite, I wound up putting some sex in, and I almost had to do it in flashback because it didn't kind of fit into the present. And I found it's one of the most difficult things to write. It was a conscious choice on my part to pick a plot in which the sexual and the political are so intimately intertwined. I also think that in real life, that is how it works, that there is pillow talk, that people who are very busy and who work very hard don't meet a lot of people in other fields, so they do wind up having their intimate relationships in the same circles, and it's not always politically the wisest move. And I also wanted to explore that theme of a woman finally beginning to experience her own sexuality, and yet it coming in this very kind of dangerous, almost tortured situation, because I think that's the case for a lot of women today.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Soledad Santiago's new novel is called Room 9. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.